Mrs. Resnick has recused herself in the next two cases on our calendar. We're very pleased to have sitting place of Justice Resnick, Judge Dan Krogan, who is the judge of the Court of Appeals sitting in the Second District. Welcome back. The next case is 98-24-95, Alice Moore versus State Automobile Mutual. Mr. Platt.
Thank you. May it please the Court, I'm Jack Platt. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Alice Moore. With the Court's permission, I would ask to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Watch your time there, clock.
Thank you, Your Honor. We're here today on basically interpretation of Senate Bill 20 as it relates to the ability of a insurer to collect under their policy for the loss of a non-resident member, family member. The issue is whether or not Senate Bill 20 overrules basically Sexton and the progeny of cases that followed it. And it's the position of the appellant that it does not. That at the very most, it's ambiguous, but the clear interpretation of that statute is that it does not in any way impugn or change the prior precedent that had been followed in the state following Sexton in cases that both preceded it and succeeded. When one looks at the changes that were brought about in 39, 37, 18, the first thing that should be noted is that the legislature intended that the uninsured, underinsured person claimant should be placed in the same position as if the tortfeasor had insurance. To follow the interpretation which was taken by the lower courts in this case completely abrogates that position. In other words, Alice Moore should be no worse off by virtue of the fact that the tortfeasor had no insurance because she had underinsured coverage. What the lower courts looked at was actually a decision out of the 8th District called Cassell versus State Farm. In fact, the trial court in this case stated unequivocally in their decision that they felt compelled to rule the way they did on a motion for summary judgment on the basis of Cosell, but that they knew that would not be the end of the discussion, that this would go on up and be resolved by a higher court. Similarly, the appellate court followed the Cosell decision and found that coverage was not to be extended. Since then, there's been a number of decisions which have gone the other way, most notably Holcomb, which came down recently out of the 10th District Court of Appeals here in Franklin County. And Holcomb, although Holcomb looked at it from the underinsured perspective rather than the uninsured perspective, the consideration is the same. And it analyzed the language that was included. And I think that's what's really dispositive of this case. And in terms of the uninsured coverage, which is what we're talking about here, the language says that, to quote, that for the protection of insurers thereunder who are legally entitled to recover damages. So we're coming back to that basic premise. Are they legally entitled to recover damages from the tortfeasor? An analogous way to think about this is that certainly, if the tortfeasor had been insured, there's no question but that Alice Moore would have been entitled to damages. So that's the first premise of the legislature set forth, that if you're legally entitled to recover damages from owners or operators of uninsured motor vehicles, so you're recovering damages because of bodily injury, sickness, or disease, including death. So the whole issue here turns upon what do those prepositional phrases modify? What is the subject of the sentence? What is the verb? And what is suffered here, if you just take a logical, consistent approach, is the damages are what needs to be suffered. And there's no question that this state, the legislature, the Constitution, have always provided, and this court have provided, that Alice Moore is a person who is presumed to have suffered damages by the loss of her son, by that death. So when you take the simple approach, which seems, I think, reasonably clear, that damages are what need to be suffered, 2120 gives us, I'm not a statute section, right, the wrongful death statute, 2125, gives us that she is presumed to have suffered damages. The uninsured motorist statute provides that she should be entitled to recover damages under her policy. There simply was no discussion, and this is interesting, and certainly, I think, enlightening, that the legislature, we all recognize, passed Senate Bill 20, in some respect, as a tort reform statute. And the legislature included, along with the statute, uncodified sections of the law. And in that uncodified section of the law, they specifically refer to the Savoy decision and their intent by passing Senate Bill 20 to overrule Savoy. Now, they were certainly aware also of the Sexton decision and the other decisions that apply the ability to pursue wrongful death damages under one's own uninsured motorist coverage. There was absolutely no reference within the statute to Sexton or any intent to overrule it. More importantly, the statute also, 2039.3718, gives us a clear indication in Section H that the legislature was aware of the conflict, or the potential for a conflict, between the wrongful death statute and the uninsured motorist statute. And in Section 8, they specifically reference, they say, sustained by any one person in any one automobile accident may, comma, notwithstanding Chapter 2125. So here, the legislature went to the extreme of referencing the wrongful death statute because they knew that there was a potential conflict there. When we go back to the initial section, which we're here about, the uninsured, underinsured section provided in Section A1 and A2, they don't include that. And yet they obviously had an awareness that 2125 provided recovery as a matter of law for a group of folks, which would include parents, siblings, spouse, parents, siblings, and other next of kin. They went so far, as I said, in Section 8, to eliminate any confusion. Had their intent been to eliminate the Sexton-type claims, they clearly would have indicated that initially as well. So we have two indicia of that. We have the inclusion of the representation to overrule Savoy, the absence of any representation to overrule Sexton. We have inclusion within this very statute of an attempt to clarify and overrule, if that's the word, or supersede would be a better word, the wrongful death statute in Section H. We have a complete absence of that in Section A. As I indicated, at most, there's an ambiguity here. Assuming that there is an ambiguity, which I don't even believe there is, I think the statute is pretty clear that the law wasn't changed, that ambiguity needs to be construed in furtherance of public policy. When you look at the public policy of the state to provide insurance, and we look at the remedial nature, we look at the intent of the statute, which is to put people in the same position that they would have been had the tort fees been insured, it again leads to this consistent result that the legislature's intent was to provide a recovery in this type of situation.
Yeah, maybe you've answered it. Maybe I missed it, but did you know the appellee argues that 18A1, the bodily injury, sickness, or disease, including death, suffered by any person insured under the policy. The decedent here was not insured under this policy, was he?
No, he was not under this policy.
And their argument is, as you know, is that the injury had to occur to that person, to an insured under the policy. Isn't that their argument? And your argument is that she suffered damages because she lost her son, obviously.
That's
not bodily injury to her, is it? Isn't that what you've responded to that in your brief, but I'd like to hear your response.
You're correct, Your Honor. I think what we need to look at is the specific language and give it a common sense interpretation. Just give it a plain statutory interpretation. And that's what I was attempting to point out, that the bodily injury is a prepositional phrase. But if we read it and we go back to whatever, perhaps high school English, and we diagram this sentence out, we look at what needs to be suffered. And if we look at section one, who are legally entitled to recover damages from owners or operators of uninsured so you're going to recover damages suffered, okay? So what is it that needs to be suffered? The damages are what need to be suffered. It's from owners or operators of uninsured because of bodily injury, sickness, or disease is a prepositional phrase. It is not giving definition to what needs to be suffered. What needs to be suffered are the damages.
Well, but the damages are suffered because of bodily injury, sickness, or disease, or death. Suffered by any person insured. That language to me is pretty straightforward, that you can opt to either insure, whoever you want to insure. She could have insured her son. He could have been named as insured, I assume, but she chose not to pay that premium. She chose to limit the number of persons she insured, and so why is this language then, why do we have to broaden the language, I guess, when the contract is permitted under the language?
Well, okay, I think there's two parts to that. First of all, I think a good way to look at this, Your Honor, is simply to read out, if the legislature had intended the result that you're suggesting, let's read out the word damages. Let's see if it doesn't give it precisely the definition that you just applied. I'm going to find it here.
Okay, so you go to recover from owners or operators, right?
And we take out the word damages.
Okay.
And that absolutely results in the end result that you've suggested there. So what we then end up saying is, well, the damages is a superfluous word that doesn't need to be there. Damages is there because they must have intended it to have some meaning. When we include the word damages, and then we read it and we consider those the prepositional phrases, the plain meaning is that damages are what need to be suffered. Damages are what need to be suffered. And because otherwise we could simply read it out and it would result in the conclusion that you suggested.
Mr. Clapp?
Yes.
I'd like to take it step by step with you, because we have not just this case, as you know, but we have Holcomb and we have Forney. We have maybe 8 or 10 of them right now that are being held and consolidated, and some other things that we're doing with them. So I'd like to take it step by step with you, forgetting that language. I understand your argument, and I've read the brief, and I understand the grammatical construction argument. Let's start with, he is killed by an uninsured motorist. He has a policy of insurance. He, the decedent, has a policy of insurance that is not exhausted by the claims of his estate. Does his mother have access to that policy?
Yes, under this court's ruling in Holt. Does his mother? His mother is remembering.
Well, that's who's in this case,
right.
His mother.
His mother could, but the answer is his mother could potentially have claims to that, Your Honor, but again, that would be something that would ultimately be determined by the probate court as to all the claimants who would claim under his estate for some of the statute.
Let's assume that there's enough coverage there to take care of everybody under his own policy. You cite Wood versus Shepherd, which I wrote. Two other arguments need to be addressed. It is contended the wrongful death statute, specifically 2125.02, could be used under today's decision to permit recovery by persons who are not in any way contractually in privity with an underinsured carrier. The mother would not be contractually in privity with his company.
Correct.
Okay. This, of course, is not the case. Only an insured under the underinsured motorist provision can recover under the policy for injury or wrongful death. She's not an insured under his policy, so she couldn't recover. Isn't that right? Okay. So your argument about the probate court making a determination, that's only on allocation and all of that. You never get to that unless she has a right to recover, and she wouldn't have, would she?
Correct.
All right. Now we go from his policy to her policy. And your argument is, as I understand it, that she should have a right to recover because she's presumed to have suffered damages under 2125.02.
Correct.
That's really the sum and substance of your whole argument. Does Wood versus Shepherd stand for that proposition?
Wood versus Shepherd stands for the proposition, yes, that she would have that aid. Yes, that she would have. It is my belief, John, I see I'm out of time, may I?
Yes, please.
It is my belief that Wood versus Shepherd does stand for that proposition.
Well, one of the things that we specifically said in the syllabus, each person entitled to recover pursuant to the wrongful death statute and who is an insured under an underinsured motorist provision in an insurance policy. You're reading that as any policy, not the one, not the policy where the person who is injured is also covered.
Correct.
All right. So what we would do is make, if I had two emancipated sons, which I do, one's in Texas and one's in Alaska, and I am killed, and my policy, my estate, is only satisfied up to the limits of my policy, they could collect in Alaska on their uninsured motorist coverage policy for my death in Ohio.
Only to the extent, Your Honor, that there is an underinsured or uninsured claim here. That's, I think, the distinction.
Yeah, I understand. We'll get to that.
Assuming that your death would have been as a result of an uninsured driver, and to the extent that they could show their damages, assuming that Alaska.
I just said there's no policy of insurance on the tortfeasor, and my policy of insurance has been exhausted by the people living in my household and by my estate. So there's no more insurance. Now, my son in Alaska has a policy of insurance, and under that, there's an underinsurance coverage in there. You say he could claim against his policy.
I can't tell you as to Alaska. Well, I can tell you as to Indiana law, he could, but I can't tell you as to Alaska.
Well, it's Ohio law we're talking about.
Right.
I'm just saying
he can demonstrate that he has suffered those sorts of damages that would entitle him to compensation.
Now, is that because of 2125.02?
That is because of 2125.02 and because of Sexton and progeny.
Now, change the facts just a little. What if I were injured and not killed? Can he claim, can my non-resident emancipated son claim under his underinsured coverage?
No, because now we've eliminated 2120. We've eliminated the wrongful death statute. They have to be read in combination. The wrongful death statute, which under our law in Ohio presumes that those persons have suffered a damage, have suffered a loss, coupled with the uninsured motorist statute.
So we can eliminate all those other cases that are floating around on all these issues and say, now you're prepared to concede this only arises in wrongful death cases.
That's the only issue, yes, that I'm here to argue.
Well, I know that's all you're here to argue, but this impacts on the whole universe of these cases. So it's just clearly the question of wrongful death.
Yes, sir.
All right. Now, does an insurer have a right contractually to say that you must be an insured under the policy, that the injured party must be an insured under the policy under which you claim?
Not under 3937.1A, no, Your Honor.
In what language?
Under the language that suggests that you need to provide insurance, make it available for damages suffered by an insured due to a bodily injury, wrongful death claim, etc. The language that we just cited right here that applies to damages or, as they're cited in Section 2, as it relates to Holcomb, to a loss, saying that in this state, you need to provide for that. And in fact, up until Senate Bill 20, where this whole question arose, that was in fact the case, and that's what was being addressed.
If you make that argument, and we should accept it, then does that not contradict what you and I have just agreed on, or what I thought you agreed on, that under a strictly an injury case, that a person could not collect under their own underinsured coverage on their own policy unless they were a resident of the household? Because you're now reading that language to say injury.
Can I change the fact just slightly?
Sure.
Instead of your emancipated children,
mm-hmm.
let's change the fact that I'm a divorced father, and my son, who lives with his divorced mother, is injured as a result of an uninsured driver.
As you know, we've already had that case.
Well, but I think that's a different fact, because I have damages that are going to flow from that. I have responsibility for medical bills, etc. I think what we're talking about here is loss and damages, and I'm not sure, with all due respect, what loss your sons would necessarily suffer as a result of your injury.
But all you're doing is interpreting that language in 3937.18 as to injury. And my point is, if you say that you have to insure against that, each insurer has to, even though it's a separate policy, has to respond, then it would include injury as well as death. And I thought we agreed that you, in these cases, you had to have a wrongful death before you could access a policy where the person injured was not an insured under that policy.
Well, again, I'm sorry if I'm getting confused.
It's easy to do it, never mind, I understand, I think.
Doesn't point 02, I really was confused, not because of your argument, but point 02 really stands alone, doesn't it? I mean, there doesn't have to be an insurance policy, certainly, for a person to recover damages for loss of services, loss of maybe consortium of a family member. There's a presumption that you send under 02 where there's been a death of a family member, that there are certain damages that flow from that. But that's not based on insurance law, is it?
No, that's certainly independent. It's just that there was a presumption created that these people, that a group of people outside the direct person of the deceased, obviously have suffered injury and suffered loss as a consequence of the death.
Counsel, so I can understand what you're saying, how it works. Assuming in this scenario that you have here, the son did have a policy of insurance and perhaps was not married, and so the estate makes a claim, and mother's own beneficiary of some of those proceeds. Do you have to wait as that becomes set off in the claim against her insurance company? In other words, are the damages recoverable from her insurance policy, only those that she can show the loss exceeds what she might be getting out of the claim of the executor of this estate?
Yes, Your Honor, I would feel that would be the case. And again, then we'd be getting into a situation where the total amount recoverable, which this court has ruled upon, would be wherever the greatest policy was, and you couldn't exceed that. So yes, there would be a set off with simply one to do the arithmetic. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Clapp. Mr. Hart.
May it please the court and opposing counsel, my name is Jim Hart from Sandusky. I'm not Jim Ty. Jim and I work together on the brief. Good morning to you. State auto policy provides that we'll pay compensatory damages which, quote, an insured, close quote, is legally entitled to recover from the owner or operator of an uninsured motor vehicle because of bodily injury, which includes death, sustained by, quote, an insured, close quote, legislature is clearly intended through the amendment to 3937.18A1 to specify that it is the insured who must suffer the bodily injury or death in order for the uninsured motorist coverage to be available. This honorable court takes that position in the whole case. On page 410 of that decision, the court states, quote, even though damages ultimately go to the beneficiaries, the proceeds are payable due to the fact that an insured party, the deceased, suffered a wrongful death, close quote. He's using your House Supreme Court's analysis in full. By focusing on whether a deceased could have made a recovery under a policy to be under a policy and he survived, because the personal representative is merely standing in the deceased's shoes in an uninsured context, here it is undisputed that Randy Moore, a gentleman who was 20 years old, Dallas Moore's emancipated son, could not have recovered any uninsured coverage under the policy and he survived the accident. And the Chief Justice touched on that in questions to opposing counsel. In this case, Randy Moore was not an insured. He was not driving or a passenger in an insured or covered vehicle.
Under your policy?
Yes.
He probably wasn't insured. He was an insured under his own policy.
I don't even know if he did have his own policy, but the point I wanted to make next, Justice Douglas, was that opposing counsel entered into a stipulation indicating that Randy Moore was not insured in this case. There was a stipulation.
But that's a stipulation of law. Are stipulations properly used for legal questions? I thought they were only properly used for factual questions. You don't stipulate legal results, do you?
I think you stipulate to a factual scenario so that the court then can make a legal finding. And in pretrial stipulation, in this case, in the Huron County Common Police Court, Mr. Clapp and Mr. Pye, my former partner, entered into a stipulation that is part of the record that was the precondition of getting the state auto's motion for summary judgment to Judge McGimsey for his consideration.
That Mrs. Moore didn't suffer a bodily injury?
That she did not suffer a bodily injury, that Mr. Moore was not a resident of her household, that he was not, didn't have his own policy, and the other sometimes controversial factual issues.
Did Mrs. Moore suffer a loss from the bodily injury of her son?
She did not suffer a bodily injury. I'm certain that Mrs. Moore suffered a terrible, tragic loss as a result of the death of her 20-year-old son. However, Justice Brogan, she did not suffer a bodily injury loss, and as a result, she's not entitled to recover uninsured motorist coverage benefits.
Are you saying that
that's
what, they stipulated, is that she did not suffer a bodily injury as a result of having a psychic loss?
That's correct, Your Honor.
But did she suffer a loss from a clear bodily injury to her son?
She certainly suffered a loss, emotional loss, as a result of the bodily injury to her son.
Is that unrecognizable as a statutory beneficiary in a wrongful death claim?
It certainly can be recognizable, but in this case she states that she did not suffer a bodily injury loss, mm-hmm. And the statute, 3937.18A1, says that it's got to be the damage has to be a bodily injury loss.
Well,
not
this
an
is
emotional
the
stress loss.
This is the argument over how that language, what the language in the statute means. Isn't that what Judge Bryant was having some problems with? Loss suffered by?
Well, Mr. Clapp recited part of the applicable provision in his open statement. And Your Honor, the statute makes it very clear that in order for Alice Moore to recover, she has to have suffered bodily injury, sickness, or disease. He wants to talk about the fact that Alice Moore is entitled to recover damages. We know there's a presumption that Alice Moore suffered emotional distress and emotional loss in a wrongful death suit. However, the statute here makes it very clear that her damages are from Moore driver cars and uninsured motorist vehicle because of bodily injury, sickness, or disease, including death suffered by any person insured under the policy. not suffer any of those things, bodily injury, sickness, and disease, that result in the death of your son. We have a stipulation that bodily injury, there is no bodily injury in this case, and 3917, is right on point.
Do you know, this is outside the record, I suppose I'm here, do you know whether State Auto would offer a policy that would include coverage for damages for psychological, not bodily injury resulting from psychological damages, but is there such a, can one purchase a policy that pay a premium, I suppose an additional premium if it's for psychological damages, do you know?
Your Honor, I have no idea. I really do not know.
Counsel, is Alice Moore contesting the constitutionality of Senate Bill 20?
She was. She is.
Okay.
Well, touched on by opposing counsel.
Well, do you know whether or not they had service upon the Attorney General?
There was no service upon the Attorney General, Justice, and opposing counsel chose that not to even make reference to that. I don't know if he's conceding that his constitutional argument is not valid because he has not invoked the jurisdiction of the court properly.
Oh, do we have jurisdiction now?
Pardon me?
Do we have jurisdiction?
Well, you do, but I think you have this. You have some of the discretion to decide if you indeed do have jurisdiction to write your opinion and render a decision in this case.
Well, on that issue, though, we've held, I think, on that issue that the failure to advise the Attorney General is fatal to that argument, isn't it? I mean, I think we'd say that.
Well, Your Honor, I don't know if the Supreme Court has actually held on that.
Sure, yeah.
You have that coming up on other cases, about Sickle versus Stockmaster. I'm going to be here arguing that case in a couple of weeks. But there's no question in this case that there was no service, no attempt at service on the Attorney General in this case, and as a result, the
So the Attorney General never entered an appearance in any matter?
Your Honor, not only did he or she not enter an appearance, there was no indication of any effort to serve the Attorney General.
Okay.
And I've also referenced to the court the fact that in Beagle, you've already determined that you felt that Senate Bill 20 was constitutional.
Did Holt overrule
this? He didn't hold. I firmly said it wasn't unconstitutional.
The court did not specifically say that Holt overruled this.
I understand that. He just said something that we didn't say.
However, the statute that was addressed to sex had been modified by the legislature. And
is that a system of oversight that they specifically referred to Savoy in the uncodified section of the statute in addressing that problem of set-offs, but did not address Sexton particularly? I mean, usually the legislature wants to clarify a misinterpretation by the court of how you read legislation would speak to a particular case. Is that just an oversight?
Your Honor, that's a fair question. I have no idea if that was an oversight or not. Sexton is very factually intense. It deals with pecuniary loss suffered by a father regarding the death of a minor child. Many courts, the appellate courts in the state of Ohio, have followed to a certain extent Sexton. This is not a Sexton case here. And whether or not it was an oversight by the Legislative Service Commission and the legislature and not also mention Sexton, I do not know. But this is not a Sexton type case. It is more like a peace case, like Justice Douglas made reference to the 2 out of 6 emancipated children running in Texas and one in Alaska. Peace case happened to be my case. I agreed in the appellate court. We prevailed in the 6th Appellate District. I appealed it to the Ohio Supreme Court, and you summarily overruled peace based upon civil war. And in that case, the father suffered the loss of an adult emancipated child. The father was actually living in Kansas or Colorado at the time. I didn't think I was talking about the facts, but Colorado or Kansas at the time, and the daughter died in Erie County, Ohio. And in an underinsured territory judgment action was pursued. And the appellate court agreed with the insurer, and of course the trial court did. And then it got up to this level, and you ladies and gentlemen saw fit to overrule it without an opinion based upon civil way. This is not a open case. This is uninsured motorist case, not a Fulton type case. The statute dealing with underinsured motorist coverage is different than a little bit different than the statute dealing with underinsured coverage.
Yes,
39, 37, 18A1, 2. And as a result, I think closing counsel's reliance on Fulton is not appropriate.
Do you know why they left the word loss out in the one statute for uninsured motorists as opposed to underinsured motorists?
You know, Your Honor, I anticipated that one of you would ask that. One of my colleagues and I talked about that before I even started this morning. And I would assume that it's because there was, by design, a determination by the legislature to put loss in the underinsured portion of the statute. If you're looking at a gentleman that went through the LSE internship program as a staff member for the LSE for a year and a half or went to law school, I know how sometimes language gets lost in the shuffle at the legislative, when cases are being, or bills are being passed on the floor of the legislature. And I have not looked at the LSE bill analysis in this case. I don't know if it was by design or mistake. I would assume, though, Your Honor, just as probably that it was by design, and if they wanted, the legislature wanted to make a distinction between underinsured and uninsured motorist coverage.
But this isn't a Sexton case, it isn't a Holt case, it isn't a Holcomb case. What kind of case is it? It's a Moore case. And I suppose Moore is less or less is more or something.
That's correct, Your Honor. Yes. I agree. It's a Moore case.
I think that we've gone through this wrongful death. I suppose maybe what you're indicating is we just sort of skirted around the edge of this one because this is an emancipated child that was killed. But I think we've discussed that. We'll have to just look.
Unless anyone else has any other questions, I'll sit down.
Thank you, Mr. Hart. Mr. Clapp, you'll use your time, which you may take 30 seconds.
A couple of points. I think to suggest that the legislature intended one thing for underinsured drivers and a contrary result for uninsured drivers is just flies in the face of common sense. Whatever this court finds, I think it has to be consistent. You can't have one set of rules if you're underinsured, a second set of rules if you're uninsured.
Yes, you can. No, you can't.
The other issue, again, is you asked about loss. It's interesting because they use the word damages. It's not that loss is left out altogether. It's simply in Section 1, they talk about recovery damages. In Section 2, they talk about loss. So one substituted for the other, but they're both there. And again, I would just ask that the court consider reading either of those sections, 1 or 2, delete the word loss against loss, or delete the word recovered damages, and we would reach the result that
I think what you just said.
Of how the appellee suggested trying to reach that being that there is no recovery. The addition of the words recovered damages in Section 1 of the uninsured motors and against loss Section 2 clearly had meaning. There was a reason for them, and that's why they should be entitled. And the final point I would make is, with all due respect to defense counsel, if it was very clear, then I think the 10th District would not have found as they did. We would not be here arguing this. I think at best case scenario is ambiguous, and under those circumstances, it should be construed in favor of the insurance.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you very much.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.